It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Chins. We all have chins. There are many different types of chins. Maybe you like your prominent chin or wish yours was smaller or shaped differently. Turns out females tend to have smaller, rounded chins, and males, we tend to have bigger and more square chins or even have that cleft. But here's the really big question. Why? Why do we have chins? It turns out the debate over humans having chins when other species don't has been going on for decades, and there have been developments on this front. Joining me now with the latest on this great anthropological chin debate, Bob Franciscus returns to our studio, professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. He's part of a team of researchers at the University of Iowa College of Dentistry behind a new paper published online in the Journal of Anatomy. Bob, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here, Ben.
Set the scene for us. I didn't even know there was such a debate. What are the competing theories as to why humans have chins?
Right. Well, first of all, the presence of a chin is one of several features that seems to mark us as a species, Homo sapiens. So it's other animals that don't have chins, and it's earlier forms of humanity that don't have chins. It seems to be just us, modern humans. And there's, as you've mentioned, there have been a lot of debates and questions about it. One prominent idea, perhaps the most prominent idea, is the notion that a chin is a different kind of arrangement of bone at the middle of our lower jaw, where the two halves of the jaw come together very early in development, as a way to strengthen that part of the lower jaw during the process of chewing. We can think of our lower jaws biomechanically as a bent beam. And so a lot of forces are concentrated at that point called technically the symphysis, which is where our chin is located. And so the idea is that a chin and its particular manifestation in us as modern humans is part and parcel of a way to resist the stresses, the strains, and the bending that goes on in the lower jaw as we chew.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this latest paper looked at the biomechanics, this theory of chins, and what was tested. What did it find?
Right. So the idea was to look at a growth series, a longitudinal growth series of radiographs of people as they developed from roughly around 3 years of age up to about 18 to 20 years of age as they attained maturity. And the idea was to try to understand how the chin develops and grows throughout that time period, as well as to quantify the biomechanical parameters of the chin as it's growing and developing. Because if it is related to biomechanics, we might expect that the ability to resist bending in the various orientations would be correlated with development, and also would be correlated with some basic biomechanical measures of how much force should be going through that area. And the big surprise, of course, was that there seemed to be very little correlation with the shape of the chin and the shape of the symphysis through development related to these biomechanical parameters.
Mm-hmm. And this is a unique study. This is a first?
It's a first in terms of applying this idea to a longitudinal growth series. People, including our own team, have considered this question in other publications. But in other publications, we have looked at static comparisons of the difference in adults. So we've looked at things like muscle parameters and estimated bite force parameters in adults. But this is a developmental analysis where we're interested in seeing whether or not the growth trajectory in some way fits the pattern that we think we should see if the chin is responding during development in what we would call a plastic developmental response rather than an evolutionary response where we might expect the presence of a chin very early in development, for example.
Mm-hmm. So if this isn't really the result of mechanical forces such as chewing, where does that leave us as far as where our chins come from?
That's right. Well, there are other ideas. There are ideas about sexual selection. There are ideas about the importance of language and the tongue and how it relates to the inner dimensions of the jaw. But the argument we favor is what we would refer to as a spatial argument. If you consider the fact that modern humans have relatively small faces compared to our ancestors, there are several features in the face and the craniofacial complex, as we call it overall, that seem to be secondary consequences of having a less projecting and a less massive face. And we think the chin is one of these features. So as the face got smaller in later human evolution, say around 100,000 years ago or even less than that, the face is not projecting as much through time. And what is happening is the chin is remaining in a more forward position or an anterior position, as we refer to it, because the tooth portions of the jaw have retracted. And so the chin, in a way, is left out there as a spatial secondary consequence.
Mm. And this ties in with a paper that you were involved in from last year.
That's right. This was a paper published in Current Anthropology and involved myself and a series of researchers from Duke University. We were very interested in this dynamic of facial reduction, and we were interested in the social dynamics that might be behind it. As I've mentioned, a lot of people have talked about facial gracilization or facial downsizing in human evolution as being a function of maybe some kind of technological change where we are cooking food or where we are processing food in a way that we don't need such large muscles and such large teeth and so on. By and large, if you want to explain modern humans, those explanations don't seem to fare so well. Mm-hmm. And what we favor instead is an idea that beginning roughly around perhaps 80,000 years ago, modern humans really started downsizing their faces in a way that wasn't even present in the earliest modern humans that emerged in the fossil record about 200,000 years ago. And that's because those earliest modern humans in some ways were still behaving like archaic humans or pre-modern humans. But beginning in Africa about 80,000 years ago and then extending to populations that leave Africa and colonize the rest of the world, we seem to have some fundamentally different changes occurring where groups are more pro-social. They seem to have larger extended networks, sort of group networks across the landscape, and are less we can see them as less isolated groups living by themselves and depending only on themselves. And we argue that in order for this to happen, humans had to become, and especially males, had to become less aggressive and more willing to tolerate, especially males from other groups, so that male movement between groups would be possible. And we think a smaller face, which, by the way, is mediated by testosterone levels, is probably what was going on as an honest signal of less aggression.
Okay, not much time left, Bob, but does that also explain in this theory why men tend to have squarer jaws and chins and women tend to have more rounded, smaller chins?
Not so much, because that's an explanation related to sexual dimorphism. Fundamentally, both females and male modern humans have chins. But the shape differences are a function of the fact that males do have, still have larger faces than females. And what's important here is that both males and females have considerably smaller faces than our pre-modern ancestors. And that's why we refer to this as facial feminization, because males today are much more feminine relative to males and to some degree even females in terms of our earlier our ancestors.
Okay, so the findings of this new published paper in the Journal of Anatomy, together with a paper from last year in Current Anthropology, does this settle the great chin debate of where human chins came from, you think?
I don't think it settles it. Some of these debates will probably never be settled entirely, but I think it moves us forward. It gives us a new set of parameters and a new set of ideas to look at, and certainly other researchers are going to take a look at our data and perhaps, you know, try to replicate our study. And I hope that it continues to stimulate the kind of discussion that it has so far.
Stimulating conversation with you always. Bob Franciscus, professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa, part of a team. He's together with a team of researchers at the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. A new paper published online in the Journal of Anatomy talking about the possible origins of human chins. Bob, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, working on our $2,000 goal in this pledge drive. Please help us out during River to River if you like our talk shows. 1-800-235-2665, or perhaps even easier, go online. Make your pledge at iowapublicradio.org. A bird flu outbreak affecting areas throughout the Midwest has now been found here in Iowa. In a commercial turkey flock in Buena Vista County, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said on Tuesday of this week, this is the first time the virus has been found in Iowa. It's the H5N2 avian influenza strain, a strain capable of killing an entire flock within 48 hours. Officials said the entire affected commercial flock where they found this disease, 27,000 turkeys, will be killed to prevent the spread of the disease, that none of the birds will enter the food system. Joining us to talk about the concerns this raises and the precautions being taken, Katie Olthoff is communications specialist for the Iowa Turkey Foundation. Hello, Katie.
Hi.
Now that the deadly strain is here in Iowa, what are your biggest concerns?
Well, in addition to being communication specialist, I am actually the wife of a turkey farmer here in Iowa. So I have some concerns on some different levels. Our biggest concern personally is that if the virus were to be found in our barns, that we would lose our flocks, and that would be devastating, as it has been for the farmers that have been affected. I think we're up to almost 45 cases now in the Mississippi Flyway where this has destroyed a commercial flock of either turkeys or chickens.
Mm-hmm. What are the precautions, the preparations that turkey farmers are taking now that this is popping up?
Well, we've always practiced good biosecurity in order to keep our turkeys healthy. And that really means that we're keeping our turkeys separate from wild birds and trying to minimize any germs that we could be tracking in from wild birds. So for us, that means that we keep our turkeys indoors. We are changing out our boots and clothing and washing our hands, cleaning equipment before we enter the barn, and really limiting visitors that can come into the barn. On a larger scale, the industry, the poultry industry, has had a plan in place preparing for something like this for many years now, and we've been routinely screening for highly pathogenic avian influenza for many years. So we have had a response plan in place, but it's still very scary for the farmers that are dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell us a little bit about that response plan?
Sure. It goes into what you mentioned, euthanizing the rest of the birds on the farm, even if they haven't been affected, and that is just to minimize any risk that this disease would spread or that birds with the disease would enter the food chain. Then there is regular testing to make sure that the barns have been cleaned out, make sure that the virus is not present in the barns anymore. So there are testing procedures in place for that. And we test every flock for this before it goes to market anyway. So there's really no risk that infected birds are going to enter the food chain. But we do want to make sure that our barns are clean before we put in new flocks. So we're working closely with USDA. The Department of Homeland Security is in on this, working with us. We're working with Iowa State and the veterinary diagnostic labs there to help us out. It's really a team effort, and I'm happy to say that the poultry industry was prepared for this, and it all seems to be going very smoothly.
Mm-hmm. What are you hearing as far as realistic expectations about how limited these outbreaks can be kept? Can this be stamped out, or should we expect this popping up in some flocks and the flocks having to be euthanized, just like a lottery, that your number's up and unfortunately it happens?
Well, I'm trying to be optimistic here because it is spread through migratory birds and the virus does live better in cooler temperatures. We're hoping that as the migratory season ends and the warmer summer temperatures come, we're hoping that this risk dies off a little bit and that the number of outbreaks will slow down. if it continues at the pace that it is, Minnesota had 4 more cases today, as well as I think Wisconsin and South Dakota had a couple of cases today. If it continues at this pace, we're going to have some problems, both with supply of poultry meat, possibly eggs, and that has a far-reaching implications for both our soybean and corn industries here in Iowa, as that is what turkeys and chickens eat, and it could have some far-reaching implications. We're trying to stay optimistic right now.
Mm-hmm. But once again, to emphasize, no threat to humans at this point.
No.
Should any of us who have nothing to do with turkey farming need to do anything differently at this point?
No. There are a lot of people not directly working with turkeys, but there are a lot of chickens here in Iowa, and the chickens are susceptible as well. So we want to make sure that anyone who maybe has a backyard flock of chickens or is in contact with poultry or waterfowl knows what to look for. There aren't a lot of symptoms, but any unusual death of poultry should be reported to the state vet or to your local veterinarian, so that we can get a handle on where this disease is at and try to keep it from spreading.
Okay. Thank you very much for this update. We hear the concern in your voice, and our thoughts are with you. We hope that the turkey farmers of Iowa, including you and your husband, keep your flocks healthy. Communications specialist for the Iowa Turkey Foundation, Katie Olthoff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Finally, a trial getting underway of an Iowa lottery security chief who won $14 million. He's accused of not doing it the right way. He's accused of hacking the number machine to pick his ticket. Eddie Raymond Tipton of Norwalk is charged with 2 felony counts of fraud for illegally playing the lottery. Now, the trial comes more than 4 years after prosecutors say Tipton purchased the winning ticket at a Des Moines Quick Trip near Interstate 80. This was back in December of 2010. Joining us briefly to give us an update, Grant Rogers is courts reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. Clue us in here. Explain, how do prosecutors say that Eddie Raymond Tipton got the system to draw his lottery number?
Well, sure. First, to be clear, the trial was scheduled to start this week, and it actually did end up getting delayed until July due to some pretrial rulings and hearings and attorneys, I think, just feeling like they'd be better prepared to take the case to trial at a later date. But what prosecutors at the Iowa Attorney General's office say is that Eddie Tipton was a computer expert, and he was interested in rootkits, kind of a program that could be programmed to do one thing and then self-destruct. And on November 20th, 2010, Mr. Tipton was in the draw room at the Multi-State Lottery Association to change clocks. And the Iowa Attorney General's office says that had to have been the time where he could have used a USB drive to install this program that could manipulate the outcome of the lottery.
Mm-hmm. And do I remember, too, that there had been a curious disabling of a video camera there?
Yes. Yeah. Now, there was some discrepancy in a hearing on Monday over exactly how many video cameras are in the room. But prosecutors say at least one camera was set to record. Usually they'd record any time somebody was in the room. And on this particular day, it recorded about 1 second of every minute. And Mr. Tipton was one of a few people who had access that could have changed that camera.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a sense in following this, even though the trial has yet to start, how strong the case is against Eddie Raymond Tipton?
Well, you know, the defense contention is that prosecutors laid out this theory, this tampering theory, in pretrial motions filed last week. It was the first time that journalists or anybody in the public had actually sort of heard a theory that he did tamper with the machines. And his defense attorney has said, okay, well, you have a theory, but you have to actually have to have evidence to prove it. And, you know, we haven't heard from anybody who was in the room with Tipton of, you know, what actions they saw him doing. And I think at this point, at least publicly, it's still kind of unknown what other cameras in the room might have showed. So, you know, there's this theory out there. but I don't think there's a lot yet that shows kind of how it's going to be proven, and we'll probably get more of that as it comes closer to trial.
How unusual, how unprecedented is this case? I mean, we all think about people hacking into the lottery from the outside. This is an inside job.
Right. I think it's very unusual, and it's gotten a lot of notoriety just because of some of the really strange factors surrounding it. Earlier this week, I talked to Doug Jacobson, who is the director of the Info Assurance Center at Iowa State University and a computer engineer. And, you know, he said this case really highlights the importance of physical security of your servers. You know, when we talk about this issue, we talk a lot about attacks to your network or viruses that could come off the web. But, you know, he said lesser people don't talk as much about this issue of physical security. And this highlights the fact that if somebody can access your computer or your iPhone, what have you, they can potentially do a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm. So it's been several years since this happened. 2010 was the alleged hacking into the lottery system. Tell us, what has the lottery industry done in reaction to beef up security?
Well, according to a statement on Monday, they've changed out some of the security procedures and some of the equipment. So, for instance, the camera that Mr. Tipton allegedly manipulated, that system has been switched out. They've introduced new security protocols to kind of highlight or to try and stop this sort of thing from happening again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you'll be following this again. The trial is delayed once again. It's taken a long time. Has it been just to the series of delays that keep going on?
Sure. Well, you know, he was charged in January, and he originally indicated that he wanted to stick to his speedy trial rights and go to trial within 90 days. And then on Monday, after about an hour of pretrial hearings, they chose to delay the trial until January. Now, the prosecution had a theory that Mr. Tipton wanted to go to trial very fast so that investigators didn't have time to dig up any potential more information about it.
Okay. Grant Rogers, thank you for the update. Course reporter for the Des Moines Register. We appreciate it.
So thank you for having me.